Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com.
Tonight on Midnight in Karachi, I'm joined by a writer I've been reading for years and recently discovered that I didn't know at all. Tom Holt, whose hilarious comic fantasy novels like Barking, Portable Door and Nothing But Blue Skies have entertained me for years, turned out recently to also be KJ Parker, a beloved writer of fantasy novels like The Folding Knife and Savages, whose true identity was unknown for 17 years. I may have come to the KJ Parker party later than I did to the Tom Holt one, but hey, I'm here now. His latest work is The Last Witness, a novella that's published by Tor.com Publishing in a week or so, about a man who can remove memories from people's minds. It's absolutely fascinating, and it's beautifully written. Tom, welcome to Midnight in Karachi. Now, The Last Witness has a nameless narrator, a man who can basically enter anyone's head and remove specific memories. In fact, every character in the novella is nameless, but that somehow didn't stop me from understanding them or their motives. When you started off writing about these characters, these people, did you have names for them? Did you know them well, each of them, right away?
I knew them very well, but at no point did I have names for them. They didn't seem to. I think, given the nature of the book, names would have been unnecessary and confusing. Quite often, in fact, particularly when I'm writing as KJ Parker, I have characters who go through a whole short story or even a whole novella without saying their names or being asked what they are. And it certainly doesn't bother me. A name pins somebody down in a way that is often counterproductive.
What was the initial premise for The Last Witness? Was there one image or a single idea or a character that sparked the entire story?
It's an idea that I'd wanted to write about for a long time. The idea that if something has happened but nobody remembers it, did it ever happen at all? How could it be proved that it happened? Was it worth it that it happened if nobody remembers it? What importance could something have if it's completely forgotten? And I've been messing about with this idea for some time, but trying to find a character, an agent who would be able to do what was necessary to get this idea across. And eventually, I hit on this idea of having somebody who could take memories out of your mind, and that allowed me to explore at least part of the subject which I've been wanting to play with for a while.
One of the themes that recurs frequently in your work as KJ Parker is the act of creation, physical and artistic. The main character in The Last Witness, amongst all his sort of other specific strange talents, also becomes a highly acclaimed flute player at some point. Yet, except for Blue and Gold's Saloninus, who's done everything, there is an absence of writers in your work. Have you ever been tempted to write a writer?
Not really, no. Because if you're going to have a character who's a great writer, at some point the text is going to call for you to produce an example of his great writing. And since I can't do great writing, I can only do sort of munitions-grade writing. It's best to lay off that. If you want to have a creative character, have an artist or a musician, because then you can tell the reader that's the music he plays is wonderful, or the pictures he paints are fantastic, and they're perfectly happy to take your word for it.
That's a very good reason for not doing it.
Well, it's a case of knowing your own limitations, which is something I do try to do, not always successfully, but one of the things, having been in this trade for considerable number of years, as time goes on, I've learned more and more of my limitations, and it's a very salutary lesson, a very useful one, which I recommend to all writers.
But along with knowing and understanding your limitations as you grow as a writer, as a person, in fact, any sort of creative person, don't you also feel you can push more boundaries as you grow?
It's something that I love to do as KJ Parker, is to try and and push boundaries, particularly in such things as form and structure. Playing games of structural chess is one of my private pleasures as a writer. I try and keep it private because, of course, if the reader can see it, then it does rather spoil it. It's counterproductive if the reader can see what you're doing to achieve your effects. It's like it's like a stage conjurer working in a t-shirt, because you can see all the things he's got up his sleeve. Knowing my own limitations helps me to choose characters that I know that I'm comfortable with, and you have to be, I think, 100% comfortable with a character. You have to know that character intimately before you can start writing about them. Before I sit down to write a character, I feel it's my duty as a professional to know everything from what that character is like to eat into their last meal, what they're wearing on their feet, which direction they brush their teeth, and everything like that. If I don't know the person that well, then how can I be expected to write about them?
So your endings are often really exceptional, especially impressive in the trilogies, where all these pages are sort of building up to a single climactic line or moment of great importance. How do you plan them?
That's a very good question, and it's one to which I'm not really equipped to a satisfactory answer. I certainly know what, when I start things off, I certainly know what's going to happen in the end. I know what the last scene is going to be, and I design my characters so that when they encounter the situation that is the situation of the story, it is inevitable that sooner or later they are going to I'm not sure I'd like to be able to plan things out and have them work in detailed synopses and flow charts written in different coloured pens. I'm incapable of doing that. When I start off the character, I know them pretty well, it's presumptuous to dictate to the extent that I know exactly what they're going to do. I have to find their way, beginning of the 19th century. It's like those behavioural psychology experiments where the mouse starts on the outside, you know, there's a piece of cheese in the middle, and you've designed the maze for all sorts of different ways you can go. The mouse decide how it gets there in the end.
I have to thank Jared Shurin, who's a frequent co-collaborator of mine, for suggesting the last couple of interview questions, to be honest, because I didn't know as big a fan of KJ Parker's as Jared is, so I would have been a fool not to ask him. But on that note, let me ask you, what was it like all these years knowing that there were these obsessive fans of KJ Parker constantly speculating about who the writer actually was? I mean, it must have been amusing, you know, to say the least.
I don't know how many months it is now since I came out of the closet. I have to regret that I had done so, because I hadn't realised just how much I enjoyed the anonymity of being KJ Parker and having another entirely secret team in my bow. To affect the actual words I put down on the page, I find that I'm rather more comfortable to say that than vice versa. I liked having a separate identity who could write things and which were not directly attributable to me. I liked the fact that KJ Parker could be anybody I wanted him or her to be. I certainly wrote differently when I was being KJ Parker, thought differently, and I suspect wrote rather better when KJ Parker was anonymous. And I think what I'm going to have to do now is think up another thing and keep that one for consideration. I did miss only just being so much nicer than there were two.
Of course, as you were saying, all the work that you've published as KJ Barker is so vastly different from what you published as Tom Holt. I know you've also written some historical novels as Thomas Holt, but that wasn't such a secret identity. This idea of creating pseudonyms, this need to draw the boundaries, was the thought process behind that just this, that you could work in anonymity doing anything you really wanted?
Yes, I think so. When I first decided to write something slightly different, more mainstream, more serious stuff, my main sort of fear was that readers who read Tom Holt books would come to my more serious stuff, whatever you call it, how you left that called, being a hearted comedy, and go away being deeply disappointed, and the people who like to really powerful, serious stuff, wouldn't want to read something written by a clown, by a comedian. So I thought it was essential to keep the two separate for as long as possible. The frustration in this, and the reason why I eventually was that at KJ Parker, I was almost completely isolated from my readers. I couldn't say that there was no easy way for me to talk to them, and that I did find very frustrating. It's bad enough for a writer who worked in isolation all the time and rarely gets any sort of feedback. The only sort of feedback you get most of the time is a lovely statement, and the lovely statement is that you select excellent books, but it doesn't tell you why people have bought them or what they enjoyed or what they didn't enjoy. And it's just I thought that it was time that I put myself in a place where people could actually answer these questions for me. Did you like it? Which did you like? Which didn't you like? I'm hoping that people will come and tell me these things.
You just mentioned in the answer to this question, you mentioned somebody was writing as a clown. Is that how you think of Tom Holt?
There's a lot of subtlety in being a clown, and a lot of skill. And there's a great deal of pathos attached to being a clown.
Absolutely.
It certainly isn't a description I'd be ashamed of or offended by.
Well, my next question was about humour, so it leads me nicely to that. There is, I think, a shared humour in both your streams of fiction. KJ Parker's work, you know, as dark as it, frightening as some of it can be, has some really funny moments. And, of course, Tom Holt's work is very funny, yet has some very dark and frightening moments as well. Humour, of course, is never easy to write. It's especially really tough to, you know, find a kind of humour that many people can relate to, sort of across, you know, genres or across boundaries or across, as I was telling you earlier, cultures where someone in Karachi can find your books and read them and still find them funny. It seems to me, though, that it seems to have come quite easily to you. Or is that just, you know, after years of writing, it feels smooth? Did you sort of work out a magic formula for what kind of humour worked over years of writing?
I think I would find it difficult, verging on impossible, not to have humour in what I wrote, because when I'm writing in the first person, obviously, but when I'm writing in the third person as well, I'm basically all you're getting is me talking, is inherent in any form of communication that I attempt to do. But I don't know how I've managed to write without it. Humor, of course, doesn't necessarily have to go with a happy story. The example that means is most significant to me is Hawkeye Pierce in the television series MASH,
where you have
a character who is a compulsive clown, a compulsive maker of jokes. He's in an absolutely intolerable situation, almost as bad as you can imagine, and he is palpably suffering all the time. And the more he suffers, the more jokes he makes. That a lot of my characters are in horrible situations, and they're not happy people. But they make jokes to keep themselves to keep themselves going, to express themselves, to situations where which are so grim that you can't describe them seriously. I therefore tend to choose characters who have senses of humour. And for whom it is natural to make wisecracks and crack jokes as the going gets. That was a conscious decision I made when I wrote my first historical novel. I thought, how am I going to cope with writing a book that isn't supposed to be funny? And so I chose as my professional comedian a comedy writer, so it would be natural that he is cracking jokes even when things are really bad, and that's to work okay. And my characters have continued up by a little sense.
What sort of things did you read when you were growing up? Did you read humour, and were your tastes as an adult, as they are now as a widely published novelist, are they still similar to the kind of tastes you had when you were younger?
I'm a compulsive rereader. I read books over and over again. There are certain books that I've read every year for 30 years. A lot of that is humour. I love my craft. I think from reading humour, and I think you can learn, if you want to learn about the craft of writing, you'll learn an awful lot more from reading and studying and deconstructing humorous writers than you do from serious writers. The best example I can think of, an American writer, Damon Runyon, who was in the 30s. He wrote little short stories. But he's an absolute craftsman. He don't say that to life and be in the historic present. I think there's one example of the whole of his work. I learned more from the way he chooses words than from anybody else. Anybody else that I've read. I think have to work harder, and they have to be craftsmen. And so when I was apprenticing myself to the trade, I was very lucky that what I was mostly reading was comedy.
Now, K.J. Parker has written quite a few novellas, of course the most recent of which is The Last Witness. Tom Holt basically writes novels. Will Tom Holt get to write some novellas? Who gets to publish a book next?
Tom Holt doesn't do novellas or short stories. He's tried many times, but they're basically just not very good. For some reason, I can get my teeth into the thought form for comedy. If I'm going to write something in the shorter forms, which I greatly enjoy doing, it is generally going. I write stuff almost exclusively in the first person. As I said a moment ago, my first person narrators all tend to have a sense of humour, But I don't think Tom Hilder is ever going to be able to write any adult stuff that anybody's particularly going to want to read.
So what's next? And who gets to write next? I like this idea of these two people in your head fighting it out for who gets to publish a novel next.
Well, the next book is a Tom Hilder book, and I'm about halfway through it at the moment. I'm doing an ongoing sort of open-ended series at the moment with KJ Parker, along with a couple of novellas. I have another one for Tor, and another one for a collection of novellas, which I'm also working on at the moment. It's very nice to be able to alternate, but it means you don't get stale nearly so quickly. They say a change is as good as a rest, and it's perfectly true. I haven't stopped writing for more than a couple of days for what 30-odd years. So the best way to keep fresh is to write something different.
You know, even when I knew you only as Tom Holt, I always thought you were incredibly prolific. But then you add the KJ Parker to the stuff, to the mix, and it's incredible because you're able to deliver so much high-quality fiction, just so much of it. How can one man write so much? Because it isn't just obviously about having many ideas, it's also about discipline. Are you certain you're just one person? And are you certain you have the same amount of hours in a day as the rest of us?
I have considerably more hours in the day than most people because I work mostly at night from about 9 o'clock through till about half past two in the morning, which is the only time when I can be sure of being able to concentrate because the phone stopped ringing, everybody else has gone to bed. And I can actually get some work done. During the day, I can get by perfectly happy on rather less than most people. So I actually do have more hours in the day than most people. I'm fortunate that way.
That makes me feel so much better. One last question that's not about your fiction, but I have to ask, how are your chickens doing?
For the first time in 15-odd years, I have no chickens, no livestock of any sort. The fox got all my chickens, particularly intelligent bees. Foxes don't have the big tunnels. And I'm an enthusiastic farmer, a little tiny four-acre small holding, which is about 5 miles from where I live, and that is why I occupy myself during the day. But at the moment, what will one thing another? There's nothing growing there apart from a few vegetables. So I'm getting terrible withdrawal symptoms. I wake up at 7:15 every day, and there's nowhere to go and nothing to do, and stuff to feed. I don't like that at all.
Well, then I'm completely expecting some foxes and chickens in the next story.
You can confidently expect a fox to if something really horrible happens, because I'm not feeling particularly pro-fox at the moment. At least I can get my revenge on foxes in general, even if I can't catch the one that's been eating all my chickens.
I guess that's what we'll have to settle for.
For the time being, anyway.
All right, well, thank you so much, Tom, for taking the time out to speak to me today.
My pleasure.